India casts its final votes today, Monday, May 12th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It was super hot for the final election day in India, but voters didn't mind.
People were all out and about, you know, strolling over to the neighborhood polling booth. And so the only person I know who was complaining of the heat was I.
Also today, a Facebook page encourages women in Iran to post photos of themselves without a veil.
These women did not have any voice inside Iran for a long time. And this is the first time that you can hear them and you can see them.
Plus, the future of China's tigers is in danger, in part because of the continuing demand for tiger bone wine.
It's just basically believed that if you drink this tiger bone wine, you'll be strong and virile. There's still a lot of people in China who seek it out.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR, TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Now, here's shocking news. Separatist leaders in the Ukrainian province of Donetsk have sent a request to Moscow asking to join Russia. Yeah, I was being sarcastic. That request comes a day after Donetsk and the neighboring province of Luhansk held referenda on self-rule. The votes have been roundly rejected in the West, while the government in Kiev condemns them as a farce. Events seem to be mirroring in many ways what happened in the Ukrainian province of Crimea in March, prior to its annexation by Russia. But there are also differences.
If we are talking about Crimea being a very flawed vote, this one made Crimea look like a democratic process.
That's the BBC's David Stern in Kiev. He says the voting process in Donetsk and Luhansk didn't really matter.
Everyone knew what the results of the referenda were going to be, but nobody really knows what this means for the regions. They have now apparently declared themselves, at least if not completely independent, then not having to follow the orders of Kiev. Of course, they already did that, but this seems to give them a legal basis for that. Now, the question is whether are there going to be full government structures? There were statements on Sunday indicating that they were going to set up everything, including an army. And also there were statements on Sunday saying that any other army or any other military force located on the territory of Donetsk and Lugansk would be viewed as occupying forces, i.e. the Ukrainian forces are now occupiers. But of course, what everyone's really watching now is what's going to be the response from Moscow. Moscow said they respect the expression or the will of the people of Donetsk and Lugansk. Does this mean that they will be absorbed? Does it mean that there could be a Russian military intervention? Those are questions I can't answer, but those are what people are asking right now in Kiev.
Well, it remains to be seen whether these pro-Russian separatists can organize a new government and army. What is Moscow saying so far about this referendum? I mean, the self-proclaimed governor today of the People's Republic of Donetsk said union with Russia would be an appropriate step.
Yeah, and Russia said that annexation is not on the cards. But remember, they also said that about Crimea. What is important is what happens on the ground. There's, of course, a lot of rhetoric going on right now from all sides. One must take everything that's being said with a fairly large pinch of salt. But especially with Moscow, you have to really watch what their actions are. So far, there seems to be they're holding at least at the moment, sort of at arm's length. But that can change.
And David, you're in Kiev. What's been the reaction there? Not just from the government, but from the people, too.
Well, from the government, as you can imagine, negatively. The general reaction, I guess, among people I know, is just one of bewilderment. It's been that way since the beginning. These events happen so quickly. And they really, from at least the perspective of Kiev, I mean, I don't know what it's like to a person in Donetsk, but here it really has a funhouse mirror aspect to it. This just seems so incredible. People here feel helpless. They also have lost a great deal of hope that the situation can be resolved peacefully. They see the clashes ongoing, and there's just a general sense that this is spiraling out of control.
And in a couple of weeks, on May 25th, there's a national election for Ukraine. Does the east of Ukraine plan on taking part in that?
Well, that's one of the latest statements from the leadership in Donetsk, is that the presidential elections will not take place there. I suspect that there will be an attempt, at least, to try to hold it in those towns and cities that are not controlled by the separatists. But 2 weeks is a long time in Ukrainian politics.
I mean, Crimea and Donetsk aren't the only Russian-speaking parts of this part of Ukraine. Is there a fear that this trend could spread?
Yes, of course. There's a huge fear. And we've already seen clashes, unrest, deaths in Odessa in particular, also in Kharkiv. Those are the two spots that people are watching the closest. But at the same time, it could be anywhere. It really has an effect of a bushfire. You never know where it's going to pop up next. As I say, 2 weeks is a long time in Ukrainian politics. It seems that these things happen very unexpectedly, and they're very hard to put out.
The BBC's David Stern in Kiev. Thank you for the update.
Thank you, Marco.
And now to that other crisis that's been in the news for the past few weeks, the abduction of hundreds of schoolgirls in Nigeria. A video released today by the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram seems to show some of the kidnapped girls for the first time. About 100 of them appear on screen wearing a full body veil, but with their faces visible. Also on the video, Boko Haram's leader, Abubakar Shekou, says the girls will remain captive until the government releases some of the group's jailed fighters. Mohammed Kabir is with the BBC's Hausa service in Abuja, the Nigerian capital. He says this is the first time Boko Haram has made demands in connection with the abductions.
Previously, they made a demand that their women and children should not be arrested by security agencies. And they said if the security agencies did not stop arresting their wives and children, they would also start abducting the wives and children of the security personnel. But this is the first time they are making demand that the government should release their prisoners before they release the girls.
So what you're essentially saying is that these abducted girls are actually part of a series of reprisals between the government and Boko Haram.
In a way, that is so.
The so-called leader of Boko Haram in this video, he's in a different shot from the video of the girls who seem to be seated underneath a tree. Is it clear whether the guy making the demands is even in the same place as the girls?
It may not necessarily be so, because local people have been given reports of seeing the girls in a number of places which he may not be speaking. So actually what happened was that he did this video and they took the video of the girls elsewhere and, brought the two pictures together.
Who are these videos aimed for? The Nigerian government, the parents, the international community, which is really frustrated and angered by all of this?
Yeah, if you listen to Shekou, because he spoke in both Arabic and Hausa, if you listen to him, you would understand that he was addressing the international community. He mentioned President Obama, he mentioned François Hollande, that is the French president, and other world leaders.
I'm also curious, Mohammed, is there anything to suggest that the international condemnation of Boko Haram is having any effect on the group and kind of shaking their resolve to keep these girls in captivity?
Yes, and I believe that especially the offer of assistance from governments like the United States, United Kingdom, and other countries, is putting pressure on the group. That's why they have decided to come out with this video to say, okay, this is what we want, so you do this for us, and we are going to do this for you.
So, Mohammed, you're in Abuja, the capital. What are your friends in northern Nigeria telling you about how, say, for example, the parents of these girls, have they seen this video and how did they kind of interpret it?
Yeah, we have been speaking to some of the parents by phone. One parent said in particular that he was happy by seeing the video because that shows the girls are alive.
So if this video is real and if these demands are real to release Boko Haram prisoners in exchange for the release of these girls, I'm sure you've given thought to how this crisis could possibly end. Where do you see it headed?
Well, many people have different opinions about how to end this crisis. Some people believe that what the government should do is to take the military option more seriously, while some others believe that maybe they should try to negotiate with the Boko Haram militants. But the government is saying that it is not going to negotiate. So obviously, if the government is not going to negotiate, then it is going to take the military action in the northeast of Nigeria, where the group is hold up with the girls. And probably the group may, you know, decide to retaliate by IEDs in some other places.
Mohammed Kabir with the BBC's Hausa service speaking with us from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Mohammed, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, welcome.
Boko Haram says it wants to rule the north of Nigeria under strict Muslim law, or Sharia. And Sharia, as you may know, generally requires women to cover their heads. That's been the rule in Iran since the Islamic Revolution there in 1979. But some women there have long pushed back against that rule. Now there's a Facebook page for Iranian women to post photos of themselves with their heads uncovered. It's called Stealthy Freedoms of Iranian Women. It was set up by Masih Alinejad, an Iranian journalist based in London. She says the women posting pictures to this Facebook page are ordinary Iranians.
You know, you'd only see the ordinary women in Iran. They not belong to any political group, or even they are not activists, women activists. They're just ordinary women. You know, so they use really simple words to express themselves. And I like that because these women did not have any voice inside Iran for a long time. And this is the first time that you can hear them and you can see them.
I mean, you say they're everyday ordinary women, but I would bet that a lot of them are pretty middle class and have the ability to go on Facebook to share their pictures.
I have to admit that, yes, these are the people who access the internet. By saying that ordinary women means that they are not, you know, necessarily women activists or political activists. They're just students, some of them. And if you see the pictures coming out from different cities, a small town. That's why I use this word, that they are ordinary women.
Well, whoever they are, your Facebook page has gotten a lot of attention, 133,000 likes and growing. Strictly speaking, though, aren't these women in Iran who are putting up their pictures without hijab, aren't they breaking the law? Don't you worry they might get into trouble?
Of course, I am worried for them. My responsibility is to just let them know that their pictures might get media attention, and this is their own decision because they've been suffering for a long time and wearing something which they do not believe in.
Our listeners in the U.S. ought to understand as well that hijab in Iran is pretty complex as a topic, and it's not like it's women versus men on the hijab issue. Just last week, for example, I heard there was a protest in Tehran in support of hijab, right?
Yeah, there was a pro-government protest, or some people believe there are traditional and religious women. But my point is, as a journalist, you should not just cover the news that you see in Iranian state TV. So that's what I'm challenging, that if you want to talk about Iranian society, you have to talk about all women, not just those women who, you know, do have freedom to come to the street or wear whatever they want. These are the women who do not have any voice in the street and who do not have any face in TV. If you just turn on the TV, you can see all women in black. But Iran is full of colors and full of thought. So that's why this page is just a platform to let them to express themselves, to be themselves.
Do you wear hijab today when you're in London, or do you keep it off completely now?
You know, it took like 1 year for me to convince myself, because I was worried about my family. I was worried about my friends. I was worried about all, you know, the judgment from the others. I couldn't make the decision easily. So it takes a long time to just take my scarf. First, I took my scarf, but I used to wear a hat, a black hat. Then it took 1 year again to, you know, just get released from that black hat as well. Now I am free, but for me, freedom is the moment when I can be free in my own country.
Masih Alinejad, an Iranian journalist who lives in London. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Masih.
Thank you very much for having me.
Still ahead, the people at the NSA who wanted to blow the whistle before Edward Snowden. On The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. I love champagne, but don't hold up a glass of bubbly to a Frenchman if it comes from the Napa Valley. Zut alors. The French will sniff and say, if it's not from the region of Champagne, it can't technically be called champagne. Fair enough, they set the standard for classic bubbly there, but that standard is under threat, and the threat is coming from something that's starting to affect all of us, climate change. Here's more from reporter Fawn Keim.
The hills of Champagne, France, roll out in waves of grapevines. Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier. These are the varieties used to make champagne, and this is the only place in the world where the coveted sparkling wine is made. In the windy town of Vertou, there's only one thing amiss in the idyllic late fall landscape. It's the flowers.
Cette année, c'est une année assez exceptionnelle.
This year was an exceptional year, very late. So we find ourselves with flowers in November.
Eric Fornell is the director of Duvalois Vineyard. He says this year brought late-blooming roses and a late harvest in October. That would have been relatively normal 20 years ago. But Fornell says the trend here has been that the grapes are ripening earlier and earlier.
Whether you're speaking of 2003, 2007, or 2011, we have started the harvest in August. The average harvest date 20 years ago was more like the end of September.
Fornell says he doesn't mind the earlier harvests, but that the shifting climate here in Champagne has sometimes meant trouble in the spring, because the grapes have also been budding earlier.
In 2012,
we had strong freezes in the spring. The early budding of the plant due to climate change makes them vulnerable to spring freezes, and we lost over half our harvest in May.
Most winemakers here would describe 2012 as catastrophic. But as the wind rushes up the valley, Fornell says that on balance, climate change so far has improved the quality of champagne.
We have richer sugars in the grapes than we had 20 years ago, more potential alcohol, and a decline in acidity, which makes for a wine much more complex and balanced.
For the moment, you might even say that the warming trend here has put champagne makers in a sort of climatic sweet spot. But things are changing fast, and it's the future that has many concerns.
So here we can simulate the effect of climate change. We can control everything, light, temperature, humidity.
Eric Duchesne enters a greenhouse at France's National Institute for Agricultural Research in Colmar. The institute has a team of scientists studying the potential impacts of climate change on grapes. Some of them are indirect.
Like an insect moving north to France, and carrying a disease.
But Duchesne is looking at the direct effects of temperature.
We are afraid because everywhere in the world there is a kind of optimum temperature for grape growing. And after a certain level, everywhere in the world you have a decrease of quality.
Duchesne enters a huge incubator with young vines growing inside. He and his team hope to learn which varieties can be bred to maintain their aroma despite the increasing heat. Already the increase in champagne is higher than the global average.
Since, let's say, 40 years is an increase of about 2 degrees of the mean temperature. But between, let's say, April and September, this increase is even higher.
Those higher temperatures are pushing the limits of any climate sweet spot, which means that sweet spot may be on the move from Champagne towards more northern regions, places, the French shudder to think, that may include England. Champagne grower Duvalois has actually considered buying land in England, but vineyard director Eric Fornell says that England isn't ready to produce excellent sparkling wine yet.
In 20 years, England sparkling wine is very good. And champagne. You know.
Fornell laughs and gives the thumbs down signal to Champagne when comparing it to English sparkling wine 20 years from now. Perhaps he's joking at the absurdity of that scenario ever unfolding. The French are certainly working hard to make sure that it doesn't. But if the rate of change already underway here continues, no one knows if the famed producers of champagne will be able to stay ahead of climate change. For The World, I'm Fawn Keim, Vertou, France.
Fawn's story was produced in partnership with the online news service, The Daily Climate. You can get a look at those lush champagne vineyards. We've got a video at PRI.org. And tomorrow, Fawn travels to England, where sparkling wine production is on the rise. Champagne isn't exactly an endangered species. This next story, though, is about one endangered species in China, the Siberian tiger. China's caught a lot of flack in recent years for its lax attitude toward the trade in endangered species, including Siberian tigers. That's slowly starting to change. But reporter Stuart Leavenworth of McClatchy Newspapers found that it's happening very slowly in China's network of tiger farms. He says they're billed as wildlife parks for tourists, but they're really something quite different.
The first one I went to is in Harbin, which is in northern China. They put you into buses and they take you out in the middle of this large gated yard. There's 20 or more tigers, and a jeep pulled up and somebody threw a live chicken out the window. And we got to watch as the tigers descended on this chicken and ripped it apart. Initially, I was appalled by what I saw with the chickens, but then I realized there's a much worse situation going on, and that's that these parks exist to make tiger bone wine.
What is tiger bone wine? What is it believed that it does?
It's just basically believed that if you drink this tiger bone wine, you'll be strong and virile. There's still a lot of people in China, mainly older people, who seek it out.
Is that the sole reason for these tiger parks' existence?
Well, these parks were started by a government ministry. China used to be filled with Siberian tigers, at least the northern part. And traditionally, you know, you would kill a tiger and use the bones to make wine. Well, at some point, somebody figured out, well, if we could breed them, well, we'd have a lot more bones. We could make a lot more wine.
So the government in China argues that by allowing these tiger farms, they are alleviating the pressures on wild populations. But it sounds like you're suggesting that these tiger farms are actually fueling demand.
Well, it certainly is the supply chain, although the government would not admit it now. And the presumption is there's still hunting and trapping of tigers to improve the gene pool in these kind of large parks. In addition, people who are true connoisseurs, they want to buy tiger parts or tiger bone wine that is from wild tigers. So this entire trade increases the demand for hunting of wild tigers.
Where's public opinion at in China on all of this?
I think there is a growing awareness. And I think that's the good news part of this story is that China, especially its young people, are increasingly concerned and sensitive about the exploitation of animals. You know, there's been a number of encouraging signs lately. A committee of the National People's Congress decided to toughen up an existing law for the consumption of any kind of animal that's protected. So this is an important step and a sign that the government at the highest levels recognizes that China's getting a pretty horrible reputation for not enforcing its own laws.
Is public opinion changing fast enough to change the fate for those Siberian tigers still alive in China?
Well, there's discussion of a really comprehensive animal welfare law in China, but these things are happening extremely slowly, and for wild tigers in China, they're probably not happening fast enough.
Stuart Leavenworth there with the Beijing bureau chief from McClatchy Newspapers and author of a recent investigation into China's tiger farms. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on the world, a new Frontline film called United States of Secrets details the creation of the NSA spying program, targeting our phone calls and online communications.
Expressly designed to find all the needles in the haystack by capturing all the needles all over the world all the time.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org. And from TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. How do you get a half billion people to vote? You take your time, of course, like 5 weeks. Today marked the last day of that voting period in India's mammoth national elections to choose a country's next prime minister. Opinion polls almost unanimously predict that Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, will emerge the winner. First, we wanted to check in with reporter Ritu Chatterjee in Calcutta on the feelings in the country this final election day. I hear it's very hot there, Ritu, and not very conducive to voting. How hot has it been, and has that deterred any voters?
Not that I know of, Marco. It was a very hot day. I actually arrived in Calcutta this morning hoping to get away from the Delhi heat, but temperatures reached highs of 41 degrees Celsius, so about 106 degrees Fahrenheit. And when I landed, it was about at 8 in the morning, and I was driving through the city to one of the suburbs where my parents live. And people were all out and about, you know, strolling over to the neighborhood polling booth. And so the only person I know who was complaining of the heat was I. Everybody else seemed just focused on the task of voting.
So your mother voted. You posted a photo of her going out to vote. I gather she's always been a dedicated voter, but this year was kind of difficult for her. Why?
She's aging. She's almost 70. And in the last few years, her health has been sort of going down. She has very limited mobility. So when I was talking to her yesterday, she said, oh, you're going to be home by 9:30. Don't worry. I'm going to keep food ready. I'm going to go vote and I'll be back by the time you arrive. And I said, no, don't do that. Just wait till I arrive and we'll go together. And as soon as I had showed up at the house, she was already sort of locking up. She dressed in this nice, lovely sari. And she was like, all right, let's go. Let's get this done.
So age and physical limitations notwithstanding, your mom went out and she cast her ballot. I understand, though, that your aunt and uncle came very close to not voting. Why was that?
So they had four men show up at their house at about 8:45 this morning. And they said, look, don't go out and vote today. There's going to be trouble. And their tone was menacing enough that my uncle and aunt were afraid and they stayed at home. And then she was telling this to a neighbor of hers who went and told somebody else who belongs to the ruling party, which is where these other men were from. And then later in the afternoon, he came and said, oh, don't worry, there was a miscommunication. Those men were supposed to go to another family. They mistakenly came to your house. Just go and vote. It's going to be fine. So they did eventually vote. But there was fear of violence. And in fact, in their town, there was some violence. There were skirmishes between the ruling party right now and the Communist Party, which was in power for 3 decades till a few years ago.
So what is next with this election, Ritu?
In another 4 days, on May 16th, the results are going to be out. So I think it's going to be another 4 days of a lot of speculation. It's exit poll time. You know, television news is going to get very animated. It's going to be another really sort of tense, anxious 4 days of waiting to see what happens, who wins, who comes to power.
Reporter Ritu Chatterjee speaking with us from Calcutta. We'll check back in the coming days as election results are announced. Ritu, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
As we mentioned, most opinion polls predict that Narendra Modi's BJP will emerge the winner in India. That's despite the controversy that continues to hang over Modi about his alleged involvement in the deadly 2002 riots that pitted Hindus against Muslims in his home state of Gujarat. Modi was and still is the state's chief minister. Zahir Jan Mohammed is a Muslim writer based in Gujarat's largest city, Ahmedabad. I spoke with him earlier today, catching him in his apartment during the evening call to prayer. He says, contrary to what we've heard, Modi's win is not a slam dunk.
This election is really about the economy. Under the current Congress party, which rules India's government, the economy has been slumping, and many who support Modi see him as a way to resurrect India's economy. Now, I think the real question is, what will happen to India's institutions? Already we've seen the courts and the press be a little bit reticent to criticize Modi, because Modi is a strong man candidate. He's the candidate who famously boasted about his 56-inch chest size. And there's a large number of people in India who want a strong man to lead India, and they believe that's what will make India a successful, powerful economy like China.
I mean, Modi has been trumpeting the economic miracle in Gujarat, which, of course, was torn up by violence in 2002. Do Muslims in India look at that and think, that could happen with the rest of us Muslims in India?
Well, I think that, you know, there is absolutely economic progress in Gujarat, and Modi does deserve credit for some of that. But what's oftentimes forgotten is Gujarat has always been a prosperous state. So, for example, if you look at Gujarat's Muslims, Modi loves to brag about Gujarat Muslims have higher rates of literacy and employment than other parts of India. But that's always been the case. Now, I think the real challenge is that can Modi spread this economic prosperity throughout India. I don't see that really happening, because if you look at the growth in Gujarat, it's largely benefited the elites. And there are a lot of development projects. So, for example, the development of a riverfront promenade has led to the displacement of tens of thousands of people. And these are Hindus, mind you. They're not Muslims. So Modi has pursued development, but it's also come at a high cost. But I think that for India's middle class, which is largely the one supporting Modi, they see it as, okay, if we elect Modi, he'll be a strongman candidate. We'll all have iPhones and we'll all have highways.
The other thing that's interesting is that this has been a pretty divisive election campaign. I mean, despite the numbers of candidates, basically boiled down to kind of a binary campaign in the American style, Modi versus Rahul Gandhi. How does that really differ from past elections?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in previous elections have really been about the Congress Party. So India has been independent for 67 years, and of that, 49 has been governed by the Congress Party. And the election has always been either pro or anti-Congress. This is really about a pro and an anti-Modi election. And I should add, there's a third candidate named Arvind Kejriwal, who's really come up out of nowhere, who's fighting on the issue of anti-corruption.
Have the media in India also kind of followed this pattern? Because a binary choice often tends to stifle other opinions.
Yeah, I think they have. But I think the one thing that's kind of chilling about this election is up until the last week, he hasn't really subjected himself to any interviews. And he backed out of a Facebook event because he couldn't screen the questions. And the media has really sort of touched him with soft gloves. He hasn't really been grilled on the 2002 riots, for example. People are sort of holding their breath right now. And one thing that I'm very worried about is free speech in India. What will happen? I mean, there are a lot of great books about Modi that were supposed to be published before the election, but have been delayed until after. And that's a very sort of chilling sign of the times that we live in India.
Could this election have actually intensified the Hindu-Muslim divisions in India? And if so, what happens next? How do you heal that?
Yeah, absolutely. I live in this Muslim ghetto, and the street that markates where I live in the Hindu area is known as the border. So supposing Modi loses spectacularly on Friday, these divisions will still exist. And I think this election has even widened the gulf, because what's really happened is for a lot of Muslims, they look in disbelief at the fact that so many Indians across the country are willing to forgive Modi for what happened in 2002. And they sort of shake their head and think, well, what is our place in Indian society if Narendra Modi becomes prime minister?
Writer Zahir John Mohammed speaking with us from the city of Ahmedabad in Gujarat, India. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
India's on the mind of our regular contributor Deepak Singh right now. Deepak lives in South Bend, Indiana, but he grew up in Lucknow, and every year he goes home for a few months. The heat may not have discouraged many voters in India, but just the thought of it almost stopped Deepak from taking his annual pilgrimage home. Almost.
It's that time of year again. I'm shopping for flights to go to India. Sitting in a university coffee shop, I surf for the cheapest airfare. But as I scroll down the computer screen, I look out the window and see trees blooming, the sun shining, kids playing frisbee on the grassy field. I check the temperature. It's 75 degrees Fahrenheit. Then I look at the weather in Lucknow, my hometown. It's 105. It brings to mind those endless stifling afternoons that feel like they start at 9 in the morning and go on until 7 at night. It brings to mind going to bed at night and praying to God for an uninterrupted power supply. And waking up in the middle of the night, soaked in sweat, mosquitoes buzzing in my ear. I look out the window again and think, do I really want to leave this beautiful weather in Indiana? After surviving 3 polar vortexes, do I want to miss the summer, the cookout parties, and the farmer's market, and finally being able to leave home without a heavy jacket? But when I look at the Lucknow weather again, 105 degrees bring another thing to my mind. Mangoes. Driving through streets lined with carts full of mangoes. The hot and heavy wind carrying the smell of the fruit. I remember holding a chilled mango, slicing it close to the seed, and looking at it with a smile, before eating it. Mango season lasts for about 8 weeks in India, and it happens during June and July, the hot months. It's not an easy decision. I love eating mangoes, and I also love not suffering in the heat. But in the end, like every year, I'm going to India.
That's Deepak Singh in South Bend, Indiana. It was about a year ago that Edward Snowden started to pull back the curtain on the National Security Agency's far-reaching surveillance efforts. But the former NSA contractor wasn't the only one concerned about what the agency was doing. That's one of the things we'll learn tomorrow when PBS airs United States of Secrets. It's the latest episode from our partners at Frontline. The program describes what was known within the NSA simply as the program. Producer and director Michael Kirk says it was a product of the immediate aftermath of 9/11 when the NSA decided to dramatically ramp up its electronic surveillance.
So they created the program. Essentially what it was spying on telephones, internet connections, metadata from our emails. Almost everything over the next couple of years was scooped up clandestinely, without warrants. Without anonymizing, a new word they created, expressly designed to find all the needles in the haystack by capturing all the needles all over the world all the time.
So this is what Edward Snowden told us a year ago. When the program began, though, there were some old-school NSA insiders who, according to your report, were pretty sensitive to the limits imposed on surveillance by the Constitution. And it wasn't just at the NSA. Tell us about Thomas Tam at the Department of Justice.
Tom Tam was a lawyer who came from a very good pedigree. His uncle and his father were very well-known FBI agents. It is Tom Tam of that lineage who finds himself working on the edges of the FISA court. Tam starts to notice things coming across that he doesn't see probable cause associated with it, and he starts to say to himself, how are they getting this information? And he asks around to his colleagues, many of whom say, I don't want to talk about this. And he says, why? And they say, well, I think something illegal is going on because there is a law, the FISA law, which says it's a felony to spy on Americans. Suddenly, the man sitting at the FISA court who's authorizing warrants sees this and says, there's something not very kosher here. I don't exactly know what's going on, and begins to worry a lot about it.
And then there's the shocking tale of the New York Times' James Risen, whose story about the program became a hot potato for his editors in New York. Bill Keller, the Times editor, was actually called on the carpet, not once but twice, by the White House. What happened?
So they're out gathering string on this, and they begin to work on a story that they were hearing bits and pieces of anyway. Tom Tam says he was a source to them. When they take it to their editors, the editors say, okay, well, we've got to run this by the government and get their take on it because they're about to reveal the program. And the government does a lot of sort of Orwellian, the way the Times describes it, Orwellian few meetings, and they basically make three arguments. It is completely legal. It is a vulnerable secret that if you reveal it, hundreds of thousands of Americans may die in the next attack. And the third leg of the stool was it is working. You wouldn't believe the threats were stopping. So if you're Bill Keller and you are asked to the White House where they tell you these three things, it's constitutional, it's working, and if you reveal it, people are going to die, you think real hard about whether to run that story. And it's also an election year, 2004. Keller spikes the story. The reporters are outraged,
I'll say. After the Snowden revelations, Obama seems to have been on the ropes a bit, promising he'll stop the vacuuming up of everyone's emails via telecoms and ISPs and search engines. Has he been willing to push back the program?
Not in any way. He, like all presidents, like all politicians, can't really afford the political cost of the potential of another 9/11. So what does he do? He takes the office. He's briefed. He's told it's effective. He gets read into secret parts of it that we don't know about. In fact, he says, this is a sanitized way to handle this. And they tell me that it's working, and they tell me that it's this and that. And as a politician, I don't want that on my record. If the blood, it's what the Bush administration used to say, if the blood of 100,000 people is going to be blamed on somebody, I don't want it to be blamed on me and my presidency. I want to do everything that seems to be available, especially if the experts are telling me it works. And they were, and they continue to say that.
Yeah, let me ask you about that brief answer. I mean, does the NSA have the goods on these foiled plots?
I think these guys are very good at spinning and talking about it all the way back into the Bush administration. You would think that they're so good at making the arguments in many other ways that they would have found a way to declassify one important one, since we all know the broad outlines of what the spying program entails anyway. Let's declassify one or two and let's talk about them so that we know that it actually works. That's really where the argument has come down to now, and it's part of what Snowden's revelations have spawned is a real, I think, hunger or thirst on behalf of Congress and others to say, let's see where the rubber meets the road here. What has actually happened as a result of these programs?
Michael Kirk, producer and director of United States of Secrets, which airs on our WGBH sister program Frontline tomorrow at 9 on most PBS stations. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Marco. Thank you.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Unlike the World Series, the World Cup is a truly global tournament, a month-long contest pitting the best national soccer teams on Earth. You've probably heard that the next men's tournament is in Brazil. It starts exactly 1 month from today. Well, here's a remarkable tale about one of the teams that isn't going to the World Cup. In fact, this team from American Samoa is considered among the worst ever. So why are we telling you this story? Because the soccer players from this tiny U.S. territory in the South Pacific are the stars of a new documentary that's out this month. It's called Next Goal Wins. American Samoa went decades without a win, not even tying a single World Cup qualifying match. The film even dredges up one nightmare of a game against Australia, which crushed American Samoa by a score of 31-0. But as one player says in the film, it's not all about the score.
I was there when Australia beat us 30-31, I'm not, but I know it was 30. The boys, they got the heart. I know they not really have the skills and everything, but they got the guts.
Yeah, once you're down a dozen goals or so, you tend not to remember the final score. But turning that abject failure around, that's what this documentary is all about. It follows the efforts of American Samoa to qualify for this summer's tournament in Brazil. Dutch coach Thomas Rongen is hired, and the unexpected happens. The team wins a game. They tie another. Losing streak over. Rongen recently told the BBC what's so special about his squad.
These are a bunch of amateurs that really love the game of football, which is great. They don't get any money. They don't get £150,000 like Wayne Rooney. They are inspired by the passion of playing the game. And for 10 years, this team didn't score a goal. A 4-0 defeat was a win to them. So for this team to turn it around with a Fafafina is remarkable.
With a what? That's the other incredible twist here. And it requires an explanation from star defender Jaya Salwa.
I'm a Fafafine. It's the third gender specific to the Samoan culture. It's very normal in American Samoa. They embrace us and the culture helps us to be accepted.
Fafafine, third gender. In fact, Jaila Salwa has been recognized by soccer's global governing body as the first transgender player to compete in a World Cup qualifier. Unfortunately for American Samoa, the win and the tie were followed by a loss, so the U.S. territory was eliminated once again. But at least now they have a respectable 1-1-1 record. The documentary Next Goal Wins is now showing at film festivals and special screenings around the U.S. Here's a young singer who's catching a lot of ears and attention at the moment. She's based in Brooklyn, but has been reviving a style of folk music that came out of Latin America in the 60s and 70s. Here's Bruce Wallace with our story.
You can't have a revolution without songs. That was the phrase on the banner behind Salvador Allende at his first appearance as Chile's president-elect in the fall of 1970. It's also a good way to think about Nueva Canción, which means new song in Spanish. It refers to a school of folk-based activist songwriters that rose up in Latin America in the 60s and 70s, rejecting the era's dictatorships. And the movement continues. Musician Ani Cordero opens her new album of Nueva Canción music with this song. Deja la vida volar, or Let Life Fly, is by the Chilean songwriter Victor Jara, an Allende supporter. Jara and thousands of others were killed by a military junta that took power in 1973. Cordero studied this history in college with Allende's nephew, a professor and mentor of hers. But it was another Nueva Canción singer who got her started on this project. Es un buen tipo.
tipo mi viejo que anda solo y esperando.
A friend played her a song by the Argentinian singer Piero.
I immediately had such a strong physical reaction to the song that I was a bit confused. I didn't understand why I was having such a strong reaction. And the next day, I was talking with my mother, and I said, Mommy, do you happen to know an artist named Piero? Because I just discovered him, and he's so awesome, and I just thought you might like it. And she said, Nena, don't you remember? I played that Piero record all day and night when you were little.
Piero's songs can be political, but a lot are also about love, like the one Cordero recorded. The theme of love runs throughout the album. Cordero says it helps balance things out.
Because sometimes the full weight of a straightforward political song can feel a little bit heavy.
Also, she says that Nueva Canción sees love as part of the struggle.
Uses, in many cases, love as a way of being brave. Similar to the civil rights movement that used nonviolence as a way of protest.
Cordero broadens the Nueva Canción movement to include people like her, who've moved between cultures. Her parents were Puerto Rican, and she grew up between Atlanta and San Juan. She now lives in New York, where she wrote new lyrics for a Puerto Rican classic called Chofarito. Her version speaks about how expats long for home. In the chorus, she urges a chofarito, a driver, to step on it, as she's headed back to San Juan.
Ay, chofarito, prepárate. Ay, chofarito, prepárate, porque yo quiero que tú me lleves.
In the last verse, she sings about going back to her grandmother's house to hear all the latest gossip. The problems are serious on this island of enchantment, but so are the parties, and that's why I sing, the lyrics say.
A la casa de mi abuela voy ligero en el expreso y me cuenta todo el bochinche de política y raperos. Los problemas siguen serios en la isla del encanto, pero igual siguen las fiestas y es por eso que yo canto.
The album closes with Cordero's version of a song by the late Venezuelan singer Ali Primera. It's a political call to action. The chorus urges birds to take up singing because, quote, our tame people are now wild and brave. I asked Cordero why she wanted to bring Nueva Canción to new audiences.
Why is it important to remember our history? Why is it important to remember the sacrifices that people have made for the liberties that you now have? I think it's important to remember, and they're also really good artists.
And she hopes that maybe, just maybe, the songs will encourage a few more people to be wild and brave. The World, I'm Bruce Wallace, New York City.
La sangre joven y el sueño viejo, pero dejándole ser pendejo.
Ana Cordero's new album is called Recordar, that means to remember. That's our program today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, the Annenberg Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Ford Foundation, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, and the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.